What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome. My name is Michael Johnston. I am the host on New Books in Sociology, a channel on the New Books Network. And this interview is being done in partnership with the Community and Urban Sociology section of the American Sociological Association and its academic journal, City and Community. Joining me today is Dr. Colin McFarlane, professor in the Department of Geography at Durham University. Welcome to the show, Dr. McFarlane.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
And probably throughout the rest of the conversation, is it all right if I refer to you as Colin?
Sure, of course. Yeah.
Excellent. Very personal. No reason to make it overly impersonal, right? I've read the book. We've had conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
And absolutely. Excellent. So a quick bio. Dr. McFarlane, Colin, has worked on the experience and politics of the city. In his work, he explores how cities are known, lived, and politicized. This includes research on urban living, densities, magnets, and wearing across different cities, with a particular focus on the economic margins. Would you say that that's about right?
Yep, that sounds like what I've been doing. Yep, I think.
Excellent. And today we are going to focus on his book, Waste and City, The Crisis of Sanitation and the Right to City Life, which was published just this year, 2023, by Verses. And to start off with, can you tell me a bit about what led you to this project and why you focus so much on sanitation out of all things?
Sure, absolutely. Well, this is a book that I'm quite passionate about. This is my third monograph that I've done in my career. And I suppose this one has been a book that I've wanted to write for a long time. Why is that? Well, I didn't start my career with an interest in sanitation. I did my PhD in Mumbai, mainly interested in questions of housing and inequality in Mumbai, so India, looking at the distribution of housing across the city, in particular the experience of poverty in informal neighborhoods in the city, and the sort of politics around that. But when I was doing that research for my PhD, when I was asking people about housing, people, of course, would talk about related questions. Issues like water and sanitation in particular would recur in the interviews, perhaps especially for women and girls. And so I noticed this theme was becoming more prominent. And then in my postdoc, when I went to the Open University, I was able to work there a fantastically exciting time with people like Doreen Massey and Jenny Robinson and John Allen and others, and a whole fantastic crew of amazing people. I was fortunate enough to have extended fieldwork in Mumbai, building on my PhD, and I focused that on sanitation in a way that I couldn't quite in my PhD research because I didn't quite have the time. Simply put, it just became very clear to me that this wasn't simply a question of, one domain of urban life, access to a toilet. This was something much more fundamental. Sanitation is a question of infrastructure and engineering, but it's also about politics, social relations, social power, ethnicity, gender, class, all those kind of elements of urban life which shape who gets what where and why. So I was really delighted to have that opportunity. And so that was, since then, you know, we're going back now, you know, 15, 16 years since then, I've wanted to write this book in one form or another. And thankfully, Verso, who published the book, were interested and supportive of the idea.
Well, and one of my thoughts is what makes this that they are important book is that it doesn't just, like, it's not just limited to geography. I think it extended well beyond the discipline of geography and the sociology and business and maybe even architectural design, right? Looking at how urban and community planning is done within the city to make toilets successful, but again, we'll be getting into that a bit more, but the hierarchy that exists within city design.
Sure.
So you focused on Mumbai, but this your writing went well beyond Mumbai. So is the sanitation crisis only something that exists in the industrialized or industrializing world, or is it something that exists outside of the industrialized world and in industrialized Western societies?
Yeah.
Where does this problem exist at?
Yeah. Okay. So you know, the answer I just gave a moment ago about kind of like Mumbai and sort of India and the kind of inequalities around infrastructure positions the sanitation crisis sort of in quote unquote the global South, right? Not a term I like very much, the global South, because I think it's too generic and to really have much application. But that's for the sake of the conversation, let's say that. But the problem with that is that it kind of like misses the global geographies of unequal sanitation provision. So you know, the book, you're right, is kind of is global in scope in that sense. You know, it predominantly talks about sort of poorer countries, poorer cities, where there are vast shortages of sanitation provision and profound consequences for not just for, you know, in terms of discomfort or inconvenience, but in terms of whether people can live viable, healthy lives at all, in terms of whether kids can get to school or people can get to work or travel around the city and you know, participate in urban life, right? Fundamental questions of what it means to be a resident of the city. But that is also true in many other parts of the world. As you know, in the US context, for example, there is a historic pattern of infrastructure, sanitation infrastructure, not being adequately provided, for example, to Black working class neighborhoods, in some cases entire towns or cities, which are massively underprovided for within certain states, in terms of, you know, proper sewage infrastructure. Here in the UK, you know, last few years, we've been having this increasingly topical debate in the mainstream media around sanitation infrastructure, in particular the way in which raw sewage is sort of churned out into you know, streams, waterways of different kinds, coastlines, mainly from cities and into rural and coastal and, you know, waterway areas, lakes and so on. Why is that? Well, it's because we've neglected the sanitation infrastructure in the country. We haven't invested adequately in extending and expanding this sort of sewage and drainage network in order that it can cope not only with a larger urban footprint, right? You know, more and more of us living in cities, but also with the pressures of climate change, you know, where you have more and more intense rainfall, which leads to flooding and pushing sewage out of overflows from sewers into rural and other areas. So whilst the book is about an urban crisis, it's about sanitation in cities, it's also always urban and rural. This crisis is an environmental crisis. And so from a geographer's point of view, you know, obviously written as a geographer, this affects all kinds of spaces and places in sort of different ways right across the world.
Yeah, I mean, I like the point that, you know, talk about North and South in terms of economic standing and East and West in terms of technological advancement doesn't really get at the global perspective of understanding sanitation crisis, because it impacts both highly wealthy countries as well as impoverished countries. And when you look at it from, you know, a very macro high level, it doesn't get at the micro levels of the individual cities where it's occurring, because not all cities within countries of high wealth are highly wealthy nor technologically advanced. One of the examples I believe you mentioned in the book is Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and how they still house an old infrastructure where they share both stem and ferry sewer and storm sewer together, which leads to major problems with the highly dense community of Philadelphia recently. And it's a global city. So what does that mean? It offers almost anything that works in transport around the globe. Therefore, it makes it highly popular for tourists to come into, and which adds to the density of that already highly dense community of our residents.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned density in a way, because I think that that's another project I've been working on the last few years, and it's the book is part of that project in a way. The book, as I said, started a long time ago as an idea, but it kind of, like all books, it sort of morphs with your interest as you kind of, go through your career and you stumble across new topics or whatever. And it is, density is really important here because you have these kind of vast imbalances of sanitation provision to rapidly densify neighborhoods. It's vitally important in particular to think carefully about the kinds of infrastructure that can cope with large densities. And this, I think, is where the spatial imagination, the geographical imagination is especially important. Because it's tempting, isn't it, from an engineering perspective to say, well, okay, here are some solutions, technical solutions to the sanitation crisis. That's great. That's important. But we need to understand how those different interventions will operate in relation to different kinds of spatial configuration. So if you're dealing with a highly dense neighborhood, for example, in a rapidly urbanizing part of urban Asia, for example, you're not going to solve the sanitation crisis with ecological sanitation interventions, which perhaps, systems, rudimentary toilet systems, which just do not cope with really high densities of people, right? Or at least you're going to really struggle to. The debate is kind of ongoing and people have different views on this. So I'm glad you raised that issue, because I think it's maybe something we can come back to later, but it's an important element of the spatial story, paying attention to spatial specificity in different cities.
A lot of people are moving married to the island now, whether they're rather bad residents or visitors to the community. And yeah, it's interesting. Another thing that I thought of this, when you're talking about that, is this move towards tiny houses. So we've got to respond to tiny homes. Well, that's going to increase the overall number of, potentially could increase the overall number of people within any given neighborhood, because it allows for far more houses to be built there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you've then got to ask the question of, is the infrastructure following? Is the infrastructure being provided at the necessary scale? Not just, of course, in very dense places, but also on sort of the sprawling edge, often low density sprawling edge of cities globally, which is where most urban growth is happening, right? We are seeing these places of hyper density, but we're also seeing these places of low density extending into the suburbs. That's kind of the predominant sort of form of urbanization that we see across the world. So what are we doing in those kind of neighborhoods to make sure we're providing the right kinds of solutions? So, again, just to don't want to repeat myself, but it's that geographical imagination of paying attention to what's going on in different parts of the city, from the urban-rural edge through to the very dense tiny home developments in more central areas typically.
Recognizing diversity and not just being monolithic, or not having a singular solution to a problem.
Sure. Yeah.
Which can have a dramatic consequence if a person has brought in perspective and say, well, this might require a solution. Which takes me to my next question. You talk about sanitation, and the first thing that comes to my mind is health risk, things associated with it. Sanitation, particularly with immediate risk, like cholera and other things that, and diarrhea and other things that can come with improper sanitation, or immediately tied to sanitation. However, are there other consequences that are associated with poor sanitation that it networks with across multiple areas of one's life? I don't want to be too blinded by this idea of health, and I think that I could be if I didn't read the book and look at all these different areas that are often hidden when a person puts their blinders on.
Sure, absolutely. And that's kind of what I try to do in the book, is to really open this question up and say, okay, well, what are the different kinds of issues and groups of people who get impacted by inadequate sanitation, right? And so health is the most obvious kind of, you know, and arguably most important element, of course, here, right? You know, is that, you know, the data is kind of astounding around, I mean, some of the macro information we know in terms of, like, you know, a billion people forced to regularly use open and hidden spaces in the city to answer the call of nature, right? Under bridges, at garbage grounds, by railway tracks, riverbanks, shorelines, and so on. So 2016, for example, something like 1.5 million people died of diarrhea just because of a lack of proper sanitation systems in the area where they lived. A quarter of them were children under five, right? So the health consequences of those kinds of conditions are, of course, vital. And, you know, the book spends a lot of time trying to tell that story and its consequences across, as you see, different kinds of diseases and illnesses and how that affects different people. Cholera, for example, is having a bit of a comeback. The World Health Organization has been producing data around this, showing that for all kinds of reasons. And that kind of thing is extremely concerning and often linked to sanitation, and should be, in and of itself, should be a kind of global wake-up call, right, about the importance of urban sanitation beyond the way in which it's normally understood, which is kind of like this sort of, you know, International Development Organization charting these processes. It should be there should be greater urgency on sanitation and kind of toilets more broadly, right? And there's lots of reasons why there isn't. But as you're indicating, sanitation isn't only ever about health. It's always spilling over into other domains. We know, for instance, that when you have an absence or inadequate number of toilets in a neighborhood, the people who get disproportionately affected are women and girls, right? And one of the ways in which they get affected is by not being able to safely go to toilets and use them, having to travel often across distances to get to toilets. Perhaps they don't have toilets in their home and have to travel to community infrastructures, finding that they can't get access to those infrastructures, often is at busy times in particular because they're dominated by men in terms of the queues in many societies. And therefore, using open spaces, as I was suggesting earlier, sometimes going in groups for safety, sometimes going individually to use open spaces, hidden spaces in a neighborhood, and being vulnerable to attack of different kinds, harassment, abuse, rape, all kinds of things that happen all over the world, as we know. Also, girls unable to go to school, especially when girls start menstruating. There's a lot of evidence that there's a higher dropout of girls from school when because there aren't provisions at home or in the school itself. So that has an impact on education and future, and obviously people's futures. And then you're looking at things like work, people missing work, again, partly because of health issues. And you're finding other kind of issues. So, for example, one of the things I talk about in the book is the labor of cleaning cities, right? You know, so to come back to India, to come back to where I started, so-called manual scavenging, whereby lower caste people are kind of like, you know, sort of like stuck in these occupations of cleaning sewers, unblocking sewers, drains, septic tanks, often using nothing but their hands to do so. This is all illegal in India now, but it happens at scale across cities. And often with severe health consequences, in many cases, people dying very young, asphyxiation from the gases, all kinds of horrific stories, right? So you start to say, okay, well, hang on, sanitation, it's not just an engineering problem of toilets. It's also about labor conditions. It's about caste. It's about gender. It's about education. It's about labor and livelihood. And so when it's about all these things, the mistake is you view it as an engineering problem that's somehow apolitical, right? It isn't a political problem. It's an engineering problem. And all these other issues rear their heads again, right? You know, issues around caste inequality, gender inequality, race and ethnicity, the treatment of refugees as they arrive into cities, where they get located, whether they get the right provisions or not, like sanitation or other provisions. These issues replay, right? So the politics is always going to come back, which is why the solution has to be one that encompasses not just the engineering, as important as that is, but also a political solution, right? About the scale of the city and how we, you know, set planning and policy and budgets in a direction which is providing for everybody regardless of who they are, and doing so in a way which is connecting to those neighborhoods and to people's lifestyles, right? So it's, again, this geography understanding, you know, what's going on in different places within the city. How do we make sure we provide sanitation that works for people? And how do we deal with the thorny politics and inequalities and forms of power around who gets what, where, when, rather than collapsing into this kind of engineering question, which is not a solution in and of itself?
One of the examples that you find in your book is it's in India, but also other places where they are creating toilet houses, they're building to add multiple toilets in them. But that isn't the foolproof solution. Like, you also talked about some of the risks and the level of security that these buildings have, where some of the toilets have fallen in other people while they're sitting on them. So, could you talk a bit maybe about the buildings that are used to, or that they're built in order to accommodate number of people who need to be gas down the toilet?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, this, because it's sort of the inseparability of the social, the political, and the technical when it comes to sanitation. So one of the things I describe in the book, there's a chapter on which I call Things, and it's really about the infrastructures and stuff around sanitation, all kinds of technologies and everyday materials that are used to improvise or provide sanitation in different ways. And I go through the kind of the different elements of the sanitation chain, right? From the toilet to the drain, to the infrastructure, to the treatment, to the, you know, to the water supply and so on, you know, the things of sanitation. So what's interesting about that is you see across the chain different moments where the social and the political come to matter. Now, some of the examples I described there do include toilet blocks that have been built, public toilet blocks or community toilet block infrastructures in very poor neighborhoods that have had real desperate shortages of toilets. So often these are very well-meaning projects run by the state, typically in collaboration with local or international organizations, civil society groups, sometimes private sector groups, and so on. One of the sad things about some of those programs is that there isn't often enough funds to build adequately robust infrastructures for the numbers of people who will then be using them. Or there is enough funds to build them and build them in good condition, but not to maintain them. And so the septic tanks get overfilled, the water infrastructure collapses, the drains break, the electricity goes out, which is a particular problem for women and girls who want to use it maybe at night safely. And then, so in the book, I narrate some of the consequences of that, which does include these kind of horrific stories where the floors, for example, become corroded through water, waste, and cleaning materials, and even collapse, and people falling into septic tanks below, but also other everyday things, you know, doors not working, lights going on and off, water taps drying up, drains breaking, or drains seeping waste into the local soils or waterways, and then that getting into local agriculture and so on. So these are always already material engineering questions and questions of planning, budget, policy, social life, economic conditions. These are constantly enfolding into one another, these different sort of domains, right? Which is why in the book I talk about sanitation as a network, you know, a network not just in terms of toilets and pipes and treatment centers, like not just a physical network, but a network of issues across the social, engineering, political, and economic domain. And I think that's really when we look at the sanitation crisis through the city, we really need to see it as a network, I think, because that's the only way we can really appreciate these different dimensions and also the solutions to it, right, which has to encompass these different elements of the network of issues which form it.
Yeah, you know, I think even locally, with festivals and celebrations in the United States where they have portable audience for people to use. So it's not the most ideal, and many times they aren't as well maintenance. And I think of that exasperated by hundreds of thousands of people in big cities where it's not just happening over a short period of time, but longer periods. Los Angeles, California, I went there a few years back for a conference, and they were talking about how places like Starbucks were changing their policies to make them inaccessible to people who just wanted to go in and use the bathroom, but instead only available to paying customers. So it's interesting how big cities respond to the need of people using the toilet, which since sometimes they were going available in some dark alley or maybe just out of frustration, not even being modest about it, but going away in the middle of the sidewalk because of frustrations that are heightened when you're not wanted in your hour.
Yeah, and particularly if you have a medical condition, you know, which many millions of people do, that requires access to toilets more regularly. I mean, in Britain, we've seen a complete collapse of the public toilet. You know, there are many cities in the UK now that have hardly any, or even in some places, zero public toilets, you know, run by the state. There are, you know, parts of central London where boroughs have zero or one or two public toilets. Now, that may not be a problem for a lot of people who will just nip into the shopping mall or the Starbucks, as you say. But for some people, particularly those who maybe are on lower incomes and who need to use toilets often, better provision of public toilets across the urban realm would make a huge difference to their lives. They would be able to go out more. There's this phenomenon called the loo leash, you know, this kind of a British kind of term, the loo leash or the toilet leash, which is this notion that people never go to places where they can't be confident of access to a decent toilet that will be open, right? So if you have a medical condition like Crohn's and colitis, you know, Crohn's or colitis, or if you've got other medical concerns, or perhaps, you know, other issues like, you know, people with certain disabilities, people who are perhaps sometimes elderly, people who maybe are breastfeeding or who are pregnant and who need to get to toilets more often, or indeed any of us who are sometimes caught in a public place in a city centre thinking, where the hell is the local toilet because I really need to go, which will happen to all of us at some point. Knowing that there are decent toilets around will give people the confidence to go out and spend more time in the city. And so this idea of the loo leash here, I think, has become a bigger problem in Britain, for example, but in many sort of so-called wealthier nations where there is there has been this kind of collapse of the priority that was once given to public toilets.
Interesting that the industrialized nation is often a great big city. I think that's somewhat a cop out, because I think that the city is still made up of multiple villages. It's just the land which it perceived, right? Like it's still made up in multiple quadrants. So to say that it's a really big city and not everybody can be accommodated, that's not true. I think that there's still a big to make the city accessible for all people.
Yeah. I mean, there's a question about whether in Britain, for example, there isn't a statutory requirement on local governments to provide public toilets. And so in 2008, we had the financial crisis. The Conservative government that was elected a couple of years later was elected on a platform of cutting budgets. And the austerity program there was about saying, we have to save money because of the financial crisis. And of course, local governments, when they're told your budget will be cut by 20, 30, 40%, whatever it might be, huge cuts, they're going to try and make cuts to things which they're not compelled by law to provide. And one of the things they're not compelled by law to provide is maintenance of public toilets. And that's so you see a sort of increase in the closure of public toilets from that time. It was happening before that, it's not just that moment, but it you know, places like London, that's, you see a kind of like an intensification of that kind of closure of public toilets, not across every single part of London, and it's, London's a complicated city, but across most of the city, that was a trend. And so the consequences now are that local authorities are saying, well, hang on a minute, this is actually creating new problems. You know, it's creating public health problems. We're getting lots of groups, campaigning organizations, representing people with medical conditions or who are elderly, for example, lobbying local states and saying, this isn't good enough. This needs to change. This is in violation of basically the principle of equality, right? In which is enshrined in legislation in Britain. So how do we go about changing that, right? If you're a local authority and you want to change it, if you don't have the money, there's not a lot you can do, right? Your range of options are limited. So therefore, it's really vital that the national state, in a context like the UK, sees this issue as a priority, not as the only priority, of course not. There are a lot of priorities, but as a priority issue, and provide the kinds of resources needed to ensure that there are decent, well-maintained toilets across the urban realm. Lots of European countries do this. It should not be beyond the power of the UK government to do this.
Yeah, the sum is greater than its part, let's say, right? The solution is greater than just sanitary sewers, but also in suburban areas. So that being said, what do you think the future of sanitation and the right to life in the city is going to be at both the local and global level?
So interesting this. I think, you know, so I've got, there's some academics at the University of Leeds who've done some great work just recently. Barbara Evans, for example, they published this great paper on sanitation in Kampala. And it should make sense why I'm telling you this in a moment. But this particular paper, they sought to understand the proportion of greenhouse gases produced by the city that were driven by the sanitation system. So in Kampala, you have areas of the city which are sewered and areas of the city which are not sewered, and where there's lots of septic tanks and other types of kind of like rudimentary sanitation systems and toilets and so on and so forth, right? And then on top of that, you have quite a complicated system of collecting all that waste, right? You know, trucks, for example, going into places and sucking up the waste and taking it to different parts of the city for treatment or not for treatment, depending on where it's kind of placed. So there's a lot of activity around sanitation in Kampala, in Uganda, and their argument is that this, their estimate is that this is almost as much as half of the kind of greenhouse gas emissions in that city. So it's a huge kind of number, right? Much bigger than I think most people would assume. And if that's true of many other cities, right? If kind of, you know, if there's a climate impact of inadequate sanitation, then this question has to become more urgent, right? Not just for the reasons I've been saying, but because in a time of climate change, where climate change will be intensifying and our efforts to anticipate and respond to that should be also intensifying, then you would expect these kinds of areas where there's big contributions towards climate change to be increasingly important, right, in terms of government attention and how we go about changing it. Their argument is that if you have a more efficient system of sanitation treatment, including the materials you use and how you treat the waste, how quickly you get it to treatment, you get a much lower clear impact on the climate, right? And of course, there's lots of complications there, which are important to go into. So what I'm saying is that one of the kind of frontiers of the future of this question of sanitation is the climate crisis. The flip side of this is if you go to somewhere like Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, where I was this summer doing some field work, you will find increasingly intense rainfalls at times, and these more intense rainfalls, you know, driven by climate change, not just in Dar es Salaam, but in many cities, can produce flash flooding, more cases of flash flooding. And what happens when sort of poorer neighborhoods with inadequate sanitation infrastructure get flooded? Well, the wastes, not just the human waste, but the solid waste, all kinds of wastes, circulate around the neighborhood or into the streams or into the farms, that are nearby on the edge of the city, all kinds of complications and impacts on health, environment, schooling, all kinds of knock-on effects on work and labor and so on. So, you know, climate change is the first part of that answer, is that, you know, we need to take sanitation more seriously because it is going to get worse in a time of climate change unless we really do intervene in it in many parts of the urban world and indeed rural world. And secondly, there are these kind of greenhouse gas emissions, for example, that are important here as well, according to some recent research. So that's one element, I would say. Beyond that, I think one of the things I try to say in the book is there's a lot of great sort of activism that's going on around this, campaigning organizations, individuals, and groups all over the world, from the US through to India, from Nigeria through to, you know, London, which we discussed earlier in the UK context. This is becoming a more and more topical issue. Yes, in different kinds of ways, right? So in some cities, it's about providing more toilets. In other cities, it's about toilet provision in public spaces. In other cities, it's about the sewage pollution. You know, there are different dimensions to this crisis in different places. But my sense is, and maybe it's just because I'm looking a lot, if that is possible, but I think there is a kind of upsurge, some bubbling up of community activism and other activism, which local governments are also involved in sometimes, trying to say, well, you know, we have to really pay more attention to this. We have to plan better for it. We have to invest more money in these systems. Because if we don't, there'll not only be consequences, right, in terms of people's lives, we also miss out on all the possible benefits, right? If you have a healthier city in terms of people's well-being, right, people are more likely to be able to go to work and school and participate in the life of the city, you know, and you know, generate more and more opportunities for the urban economy and for the social life of the city. This is why I talk about this is a crisis of city life, right? You know, it's not just about all of their toilets. It's about, do people have the capacity to thrive in the city, right? So that's why I talk about the right to city life, to sort of borrow Henri Lefebvre's kind of famous right to the city idea. So I think that there is evidence that activism is driving the political agenda here. So those are two kind of key areas, climate change and kind of like, you know, what people are increasingly doing around this. All kinds of people, by the way, not necessarily the most radical people who are driving this. Lots of folk are pushing this agenda in different ways across the world. That gives certainly me a bit of hope, and I talk about that in the book, you know, some hope there. And probably the last thing I would say is that there are also some great examples of cities and countries which have turned this around, which I discuss a bit in the book. You know, cities that have built simplified sewerage systems, low cost, you know, cheaper materials that provide, you know, in some cases, real life saving infrastructures to neighborhoods, refugee camps, all kinds of spaces. So you know, the evidence is that people can and cities do, when they take this seriously, make some significant inroads into improving people's well-being and the right to city life, as I was saying.
Yeah, you know, I think the concept of, you know, spend a little bit of money now to save money later. And I think that there is something that he said about this when looking at sanitary expenditures, like moving from toilets to the drains and the tanks that the sewage eventually makes its way to. But I think that can be said because of all the networks that it connects to, and if a person has access to proper sanitation, it may save money in the area of education that is lost. It may save me in the area of health that is lost, that would only lead to if a person has long periods of going without proper sanitation.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I'll just say briefly on that, that the one of the discussions I have in that chapter I mentioned, the chapter on things, is around the sewer. And I think sewers are incredibly expensive. They're often very water intensive. They're hugely disruptive to build, right? You often have to close down transport networks in certain places to build them for long periods of time. You know, they it's hard to sometimes get voters to feel excited about a sewer extension. You know, it's a hard sell for politicians, even when they believe in it. But there is lots of evidence that sewers, especially in areas of high density, you know, you'll get the money back if you invest the time, difficulty, inconvenience, and financial loss. And some, right? You know, there's some numbers and data around this in the book where I talk about, you know, the return of investment. But sometimes it's decades right before you see that money come back, in a sense, to the national or local government. But, you know, if you have those longer-term big solutions which can provide for, as I said, high-density cities in particular, or high-density areas, which people can rely on, right, rather than these haphazard systems where you're replacing them over and over again, with not very well maintained, they don't quite manage to provide the numbers of people using them, they break down a lot, you know, probably ends up being more expensive over time anyway. So it's trying to see, you know, trying to almost reignite some faith in basic systems like the sewer, right, which has probably had a bit of a bad press. As a, you know, water-intensive, expensive system. There are different ways of building these systems. There are different ways of using water so that you can recycle rather than use sort of clean water to you know, is a bit bonkers to be flushing clean water down the sewers, especially in cities and parts of the world where there is, you know, a drier climate, and perhaps even an increasingly dry climate in many cities. So I recognize it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, but it just one of the arguments I made in the book is just about trying to remember the possibilities that sewers enable, unglamorous as they may be. So yeah, just tagging on to what you were saying there, Michael.
And particularly when there's a change of guard taking place and people who are our leaders maybe in office during the time of the solution, but then a new person comes in and has a different vision of the city. So it makes it difficult to, you know, across changing of guards, maintain a single solution and see it through.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, if it's expensive, it's very easy for the next incumbent to say, well, we'll scrap that because it wasn't our idea. And it's a lot of money, you know, and, you know, so yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Well, over time, this is going to be an ongoing discussion. And I don't think that it ends today with you and I, Colin, but I think it's something that can even continue on with people who listen to our talk and read your book and hopefully it continues into future books that are written and future policy that is made around the world.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's an issue I care about a lot. And there are lots of other people who are doing work like this. So I see in the book, I tried to point to some of that work. And yeah, I agree. It's a set of issues which are systemic and which absolutely are urgent and require much more focus.
Unfortunately, we are out of time for our main talk about this book. However, one of the things that I'm always yearning to know is, you know, what's your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I mentioned density earlier, and that has been a project which I've been working on now for a few years. We had a project funded by the European Research Council to understand people's experiences of urban density in different parts of the world. And that had a bit of an impact because of the pandemic, because obviously the one thing that wasn't happening in many places during the pandemic was density, for obvious reasons. At the moment, I'm writing up lots of that work with colleagues, you know, brilliant colleagues who I've worked with on that project. We've just finished a comic book, which I'm super excited about. It's actually going to the printers as we speak. And I'm hoping, although it's always something you sort of don't want to say out loud, but I'm hoping to write a book about density. When that happens, it's another question. I've learned not to promise, not to say when, because these things are very difficult to you know, as you know, they're massive projects and don't need, you know, it's hard to predict exactly. But that's my kind of aim, is to try to write a book about, you know, what paying attention to density tells us about cities and urban change.
I hope that you will stay in conversation with me and keep me updated on where this project takes you. And then also let me know once the comic is out about density. I'd love to look at that and wrote it however I can.
Will do. Absolutely. I'll send it.
Well, again, this is another episode of New Books in Sociology, a channel on New Books Network. I'm Michael Johnston, a host on New Books in Sociology. This has also been a partnership with the Community and Urban Sociology section of the American Sociological Association and its academic journal, City and Community. Again, Colin, thank you for joining me today, and have a great rest of your week.
Thank you, Michael. Real pleasure.